Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a crucial time today when leadership across government, business, and diplomacy seems to be lacking, my guest today has written an account of how five ordinary people, shaped by crisis, became extraordinary leaders. Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times describes the lives and skills of five remarkable people at the precipice of disaster who, through their will and skills, became influential leaders. In it, we meet polar explorer Ernest Shackleton, trapped on an Antarctic ice floe at the beginning of his 16-month ordeal to bring himself and his crew all back to safety. Abraham Lincoln, in the dark year of his presidency, 1862, when it appeared that the Union would not last. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass. We meet him as an escaped slave in safety, going back to the country that could send him back to captivity. Nazi resisting minister Dietrich Bonhoeffer, agonizing on how to resist evil from the pulpit. And environmentalist Rachel Carson, in a race with cancer, to tell the story of pesticides' harmful effects on the environment. Forged in Crisis author Nancy Kane is my guest. She's a historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her work involves describing the critical leadership skills needed in a whole range of areas, government, business, education, and the arts. She's spoke at the Aspen Ideas Festival and the World Economic Forum in Davos, and is the author of numerous books, articles, and Harvard Business School cases. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Nancy Kane, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich. Appreciate it.
A lot of people in this country are lamenting the lack of leadership in our country. And before people jump to a conclusion, I'm talking about all across the political spectrum, and not just now, but almost a generation of a troubling lack of leadership. What attracted you to these five subjects as an antidote?
Well, I wasn't really writing initially in response to the public stage. So these are individuals from the past, the Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton, Lincoln, the 16th president, Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave and abolitionist, this very interesting clergyman who many Americans have never heard of, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who became an active member of the resistance against Hitler, and then this fascinating, brave woman, environmental crusader, Rachel Carson. Rather than thinking about what's the stage of the present like, I was following this thread. I mean, Rich, historians, we work like detectives. We work inductively. We don't start with a theory. We're following clues. And the clues I was following at the time, when I began this some 13, 14 years ago, was what does it mean to navigate through crisis? And how do you navigate through crisis without getting angry and bitter and being defined by it? And how do you learn? What do you learn in crisis, right, when you're either figuratively, literally, or both on your knees and the winds are, you know, high and the waves are big and crashing around you? And that was the thread I was following. And each of these people in this book, right, turn out to be people who learn to navigate crisis first within themselves, right? How do I deal with this emotionally? How do I deal with this in terms of what I think is possible and for myself and for whom I might become in the crucible of crisis? And then how do I use that learning to make a worthy difference on whatever stage I'm on, a worthy difference, or embrace a big, you know, decent purpose? And so all of that, those were just detective stories I was involved in, and they were all very different. And I was choosing these people based on the evidence I had, right? You're a historian, you need clues. You need a historical record of an emotional experience. Diaries, letters, intimate, you know, communication. So I was following threads where there was evidence, where there was cloth to unravel. And then as I put the stories together, start each one by one, and then going back to one, and then going back to another, and, you know, redrafting, I realized that what I emerged with, what the whole was a story about the making of courageous leaders. That's, again, I worked from the bottom up, so I didn't set out to say, well, here are courageous leaders. Where are they now? Or where are these kind of people on our national stage today? But that's inevitably the question the book raises. Without my intending it to from the beginning, the hope I had for the book, and I still think it's a viable one, is people will read these stories, realize how ordinary these people ultimately were, and how they made themselves capable of doing something extraordinary, and take inspiration and dedication to that in their own leadership path. So that was the object. And it still begs the question, where are they today? I'm happy to talk about that if you like, but the book now really lays that glove on the ground because these people turn out to be so decent and, you know, as full of compassion as they are of courage and of a big, mighty purpose.
As I was reading it, I was thinking of not America being in a crisis, but on the verge of a crisis. And maybe that crisis is 3 years, 2 years, or even 10 years down the road. But I feel like we're in this situation where we're on the verge at some point. And as I read these stories, I was really struck by how each of these five individuals related to crisis. Some were quickly thrust into crisis. Others could see it coming and made conscious decisions based on it.
They did. And there, I think, as you know from reading the book, this is a storybook, but because it was a book that was born out of a historian at the Harvard Business School, and because I taught, I mean, I had the wonderful opportunity to pilot each of these drafts with executives and MBA students. So I got a lot of great feedback over the years from actors, you know, pragmatic people of action that I taught. And because of that, each of the stories is laced with, because of that, if you will, creation process, each of these stories is laced with these interesting lessons, these insights that these people learn, everything from, you know, Lincoln learning that the higher the stakes of the situation, actually the slower the leader wants to move, slow everything down when the stakes get really high. Kennedy learned the same lesson. John Kennedy learned the same lesson in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Our president needs to learn that lesson. Some of our congressmen of both parties need to learn that lesson. The importance of showing up, regardless of how vulnerable or doubting or depressed a leader feels, showing up with your followers in service to your mission with purpose and confident conviction. You know, two lessons about in crises, there's never one silver bullet. It's always more complicated than that. So how do you disentangle yourself from the idea that I need one silver bullet and get frustrated about not having it, and then focus on the myriad of things you need to do to navigate the waves and the high winds. And so the book, I think, is particularly timely because it shows us people with very little to start with that made themselves capable of doing these very big, very good things. Secondly, it suggests that when one puts the narcissistic, self-interested gas tank right aside, which each of these people do, it happens. They don't set out to do that, but their initial focus on their agendas, or each of their agendas, I, you know, gives way to, wait a minute, the purpose is really about serving others. And in serving others, I actually feed myself. I find my power. I find my satisfaction, my destiny. I mean, our leaders could use all of that right now. They could use a sense that it's not just your question, it's not just about reactivity, it's also about looking ahead and making plans and thinking about what's coming down the road and adapting and adjusting and governing with those ends in mind. And again, all those aspects of sound common sense leadership, we find ourselves largely frustrated in our search for them right now, at least on the national political stage.
The book seemed to break down into two different types of leadership. It's sort of personal leadership that is exemplified by Frederick Douglass, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Rachel Carson, this personal, enormous personal courage in speaking out for what they believe is right. In the case of Shackleton and Lincoln, you have actual leaders who are responsible for the people under their watch. And your point about relinquishing the I is certainly very important in the ideal of Shackleton. Here's a man, you know, he's an Antarctic explorer. This is all about becoming famous, you know. And when his ship is trapped in sea ice in January 1915 and 16 months trapped by himself, he took responsibility for the situation and put his men first, which I thought was, and both of those leaders always took responsibility for their situation and thought of the consequences of their actions on the people around them.
They certainly did. And, you know, I think, and that's a really interesting kind of typography for the book, personal leadership, and then this, if you will, you know, larger leadership of larger groups. Douglass ended up leading a lot of people in the abolition movement, so he might cross the bridge or straddle the line here in terms of personal and collective leadership. But it's true of him as well, that each of these people, you know, owned all the responsibility, right? Jekyll's like, it's my responsibility to get my men home safely. Lincoln, it's my responsibility to keep the nation together. And then midway through the war, it's my responsibility to end slavery and restore the promise of America. And they owned it full on. And in the ownership of it, they, again, discovered previously unknown reserves of strength, of ingenuity. There's a lot of improvisation in this book, which I thought was very interesting. These people, you know, at some points are making it up as they go along because because the winds are high and the waves are big and it's hard to sail the vessel, so to speak, of their mission. And they're making it up. And then also this great, constantly improving sense of emotional awareness they have, not only about themselves, but then what that means for how they communicate with their followers, how they motivate people, how they keep people like Shackleton, keeping his men sailing in those lifeboats toward the end of the journey when they're trying to get to land and the men are ready to give up. And Shackleton himself, you know, stands up in the lead lifeboat and just stands there, you know, in gale force winds for 30 some hours as a symbol of, you can do it. I am going to lead you, you know, to land, and you're going to keep rowing. And so in all these ways, these individuals, right, discover that owning the responsibility of their mission and the people that their mission encompasses is not only a grave and often difficult one, but ultimately an empowering, right, an empowering and noble's a little strong, but an empowering and honorable one that they individually draw strength from.
You mentioned him standing in the front of the front lifeboat. People might get the wrong idea, but one of his other pieces of brilliance was the way he manages crew's energy.
Yeah.
He was the person that was like, okay, let's give you a little extra. And both Lincoln and Shackleton were incredibly positive, at least how they faced their charges, if you will.
They were. And I mean, well, first, managing the energy of a team is something that I've noticed, speaking about this again with lots of different executives, has a lot of traction because I think there's so much fear. Our attention spans are short. They're fractured. We're playing with our phones all the time. We're having trouble focusing. That managing the energy piece is just really critical to running an effective team and to keeping people really engaged in doing their best work or finding their best selves. And Shackleton was a master at everything from, as you just said, you know, when he'd see a man flagging, he'd order up hot milk for all the men so he could get a man's physical energy up, which would help his emotional energy. And yet, by ordering milk for everyone, he didn't embarrass the man that was flagging. The man never knew that Shackleton knew he was weakening. And to Lincoln, who we know suffered an enormous amount of guilt, a great deal of depression about the bloodshed of this war, which was unlike any other American.
And he was prone to depression throughout his life.
All his life. I mean, today we would have medicated him. We would have called him chronically depressed. He'd be on Zoloft or Wellbutrin, and you know, he would be managing in a very different way than he did. But there was no question he was a man who suffered from regular depression. He called it the hypo, by the way, and he knew when it was coming, and he learned over his lifetime how to manage himself in those canyons, in those emotional canyons. But he never, we know from people very close to him in the White House, especially his aides and his wife, that, and a few trusted cabinet members, that he would he would find his way to despair. I mean, he would just be wanting to give up. And yet, he didn't. That's critically important, right? The line that separates giving up from not giving up is a thin one, and yet it makes all the difference. And he never showed up in public with anybody he didn't really know well and trust, and that was a small circle of people for Abraham Lincoln that he did trust. He never showed up looking like he wasn't firmly resolved to accomplish his purpose, and he believed he could do it. And that was important because, as you know so well, and your listeners know so well, if the leader shows up, you know, fearful, full of doubt, really, really anxious, then that will just spread throughout his followers like wildfire, like, you know, flu in a kindergarten. And that can destroy a mission, a purpose, an endeavor faster than anything. So all of these people, Bonhoeffer included, find the strength, the emotional discipline to show up, you know, with dignity and conviction every single time they're in front of the people that are following them or they're leading.
My guest today is Nancy Kane, a historian at the Harvard Business School and the Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her book is titled Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. It's published by Scribner's, and she combines biographies of Ernest Shackleton, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Rachel Carson with stories about their leadership, but mainly it looks at them from a leadership viewpoint, and it's a really interesting book. When you're mining somebody like Abraham Lincoln, who is I mean, how many biographies and how many studies has been made of this president? Was there anything that was particularly new and interesting that you found as you were looking into his life?
So it's a great question. It's fair, and it's an important question. A couple of things, and I was very conscious of the fact that, you know, there are more books reputedly written about Lincoln than there are about Jesus. So we're not talking about someone who hasn't had a lot of copy expended on his life and his presidency. And I knew that, and I was fascinated by Lincoln, but I also felt the burden of mostly fine scholarship that's gone before me, but the need, in some sense, to justify the reader's attention on this biography by providing something that was novel, and not novel for the sake of novelty. I'm not that kind of person. I'm not that kind of scholar or writer, but novel because it was important for people today to understand about Lincoln. So a couple of things I think I uncovered that were interesting to me and that are part of the book. One is that this is not the story of Lincoln as the commander-in-chief. It's not the story of Lincoln as the calculating and very brilliant party politician that he was. It's not the story of Lincoln as the great emancipator. It's not the story of Lincoln as a husband and a father, although, as you said, these are biographies, right, masquerading as leadership lessons, or vice versa, leadership lessons masquerading as biographies. It's not any of those stories. It's the story of a human being who found himself in a rolling series of crises, particularly once he was president, and he'd had many before, but in between those waves, right, learned two really interesting new things. First, that leading in crisis, leading in turbulence, leading in the kind of volatility our country's now experiencing and much of the world is undergoing, is also not just about taking action in that volatility, not just about trying to navigate through it. It's also about communicating the redemptive insights, possibilities, trade-offs, and frame of a crisis. So people look at moments of crisis to the leader. They don't want the leader to necessarily solve it, because most people understand certain kinds of calamities or emergencies or turbulence can't be solved with a fell swoop. But they want the leader to tell them, explain to them what's going on in a sense of, what does this mean, this challenge, this uncertainty, this ambiguity for us? Wow. Like, think about Franklin Roosevelt, right, when he first inaugurated in 1933. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. The leader also has to frame the crisis, Rich, right? He or she has to say, here are the waves, here are the winds, here's how we'll navigate, here's what it means emotionally, here's how we want to think about this experience as a collective, as a group of people trying to move through the crisis and on to better shores and a better purpose. So if you think about the Gettysburg Address, for example, we talk about it, you know, as a brilliant piece of rhetoric, as a brilliant description of the promise of America and the testing of that promise in the Civil War. We never talk about it as a leader trying to, in the middle of an astounding change process, you know, turbulent moment, trying to frame that turbulence, explain to people what their role is in that turbulence, call them to the mission that's in front of that turbulence. And we don't think about it that way, but that's what it is. And so Lincoln's genius, among many, many gifts, among many things he learned about himself, lessons he harnessed, was to be able to communicate the crisis of the Civil War, not only, you know, with a sense of the mission of saving America and then transforming it, but also with a sense of what the emotional experience was like of a nation tearing itself in two and losing so many of its citizens in the bloodiest war this country has ever known. So that is a really, if you will, fresh insight about Lincoln. And it's a very important insight for leaders today, many of whom look to Lincoln as an icon. But the second thing I think that's interesting about the chapter, and I believe new, is that we get a sense of Lincoln's emotional experience and of his humanity. You know, we get a sense of what he eats and how he loved his sons and what his marriage was like. And, you know, how he liked hot black coffee and the bawdy, raunchy jokes he told his aides to relieve the stress of his office. And many, many fine books about Lincoln don't really bring him out of the marble. He lives in marble for so many of us. I had an explicit intention of trying to understand the man, which we are, because we're all people. We lead in different ways, but we're all at the end, you know, utterly mortal, utterly human. And I wanted that to come across in the chapter. And I think it succeeds. I have so many people have come to me after they've read this or read it in an earlier draft and said, gosh, I really had no sense of Abraham Lincoln as a person. And so I wanted that to be part of the story, and I worked very hard to uncover that. Because I think, how can we appreciate Lincoln if we think he's this god that sits, you know, immortalized by Daniel Chester French in the Lincoln Memorial? And so that was the second aspect of the chapter I think is new, and I hope interesting, compelling for my readers.
Well, and I think that you detail how Lincoln was human, and he learned by doing, and he made a lot of mistakes as president, some that he would readily admit. He was slow to dismiss cabinet members that were really scheming against him. He was slow to change generals and find a general that would help him win the war. And I also love the way that you expose these people as human. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who is, again, very much a saint-like figure for people who do know him, is standing up against the Nazis in the pulpit. Even after he doesn't have an official pulpit to speak from, he's still speaking out. But in the early days, he succumbs to his fear, and he sort of follows Nazi biddings at times.
He does.
And he has these immediate recriminations about kowtowing to the regime, if you will.
How could I have been so cowardly? He asked himself, right?
Yeah, and that's another essential part of all of these folks, is that they are human, they do make mistakes, and they learn from them.
And they learn from it. And again, I was at pains, ultimately satisfying pains, to describe that humanity and the mistakes, because I found myself after 20 years at the Harvard Business School thinking in biographical terms. I'm a biographer more than I'm any other kind of historian, and that's how I live and learn in terms of learning from lives. And I found myself a little bit frustrated by the idea of the Superman or Superwoman leader, and, you know, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, you know, compensated beyond belief in Fortune 500 boardrooms, and just unique and special and non-failing, you know. And the more I learned, both in my own coaching work with executives and my own research as a historian and biographer, the more I thought leadership in any realm is very messy, because we are humans and we make mistakes, and we never get out of jail free card for making mistakes. And how do we learn from them? And how do we, you know, ultimately, if you will, keep on coming back from them to do something that makes more sense, and without getting mired in the self-doubt, recrimination, narcissism that can accompany mistakes, especially for high-achieving people. And so I was really interested in that, and I wanted these people to walk off the page for the reader and the paper person to go, oh, that's who this person was, right? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you know, he loved tomatoes. He loved to beat his students, the students who were studying for ordination at ping pong. Like, those are things we remember. Lincoln, you know, giving away the family dog when he's elected president and they're going to Washington, and then carrying over the dog's favorite sofa to the neighbor they gave the pet to. I mean, those are the things that help us understand who these people were, because they were people, first and foremost. And I wanted, if the book was going to be credibly inspiring, people had to be able to relate to other individuals. So that's a piece of the book that was important to me.
One of the things that, you know, I remember back in the first Gulf War, a general standing up at one of those televised briefings and saying that, you know, Saddam Hussein had a sort of a zero defect mentality, and some general who did something on the other side was probably gone away permanently. And I'm wondering if today we have sort of a zero defect mentality towards our leaders, and whether that's healthy.
It's not healthy. And then we probably do, in that sense we're setting ourselves up for disappointment and disillusionment. But by the same token, getting back to something you raised at the very beginning of the conversation, right? The same token, we're watching the degradation of at least the standards of behavior of very public political leaders. This is not a Republican or a Democratic comment. It pertains to politicians from across the partisan spectrum. We're just watching a degradation in conduct that is, as I say to people, I think it's shameful for our children to see. So we may be overly critical and too quick to judge and too quick to dismiss, but we're also living in a moment when we see way too few, at least individuals at the highest levels of the national government, showing up in service to the mission of public service. That's just a tragedy. And we need ordinary citizens need to acknowledge that, vow to be more discriminating and discerning in who we elect, and we also need to say, well, this may be happening in Washington, but it's not happening in my school. It's not happening with my kids. It's not happening with my colleagues. It's not happening with the folks that I'm responsible for in my job. It's not happening with my neighbors. I mean, the way to win back the idea of courageous leadership in our country is for each of us to step up to the plate and demonstrate it, as opposed to dismissing our leaders because we have zero tolerance or thinking somehow that what is right now going for acceptable is acceptable. It's not. It's not.
The name of the book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. My guest today is Nancy Kane. She is a historian at the Harvard Business School and the chair of business administration, the Robison Chair of Business Administration there. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. These five subjects, Shackleton, Lincoln, Douglas, Bonhoeffer, Carson. Is there one trait that you can say connects to all five of them that is worthy of emulating?
Probably the most important common thread is the decision in the midst of crisis to make something better of themselves, even if they're not exactly sure what that is, to become somehow bigger and braver and more luminous, even if they don't know how to do that, even if they don't know how to survive the crisis. And that decision, that pact with oneself, turns out to make this tremendous difference as they go forward in navigating the crisis, in then accomplishing what they set out to accomplish, in helping others learn, as we're learning today from this book, from their examples, in really, if you will, right, moving the boulder of goodness forward. So the message is do not underestimate the power of your ability to get better and better and to have that pact with yourself and to rock the world in your way, in your sphere. You know, Margaret Mead, the American anthropologist, once said, never doubt the ability of a small group of concerned citizens to change the world. Indeed, nothing else ever has. And these stories are testament to that, right? One person who gathers a small group of people, who gathers a larger group of people, who in the midst of crisis, right, says, I'm going to find the diamond in the rough, and does exactly that, finds the diamond, changes themselves, changes the world. We need more of that right now.
Or in the case of Rachel Carson, solitarily writing and telling a story and sharing it with everyone.
Absolutely. And doing it, you know, as an introvert and a shy person. I mean, she's a wonderful example, right, of the myth of charismatic, you know, hard-driving leadership as the only way to be an effective leader. She's quiet, she's shy, she's alone, she's a writer. And she's arguably as important as any figure in this book in terms of her impact and more influential than many presidents we've had in this country. She's quite amazing.
Well, Nancy Kane, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich. A great pleasure.
Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School and the Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her new book is titled Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.